Welcome to Frank on Target, your gateway to the world of politics, controversy, and the great outdoors. Join us as we dive into the heart of today's most pressing issues, explore the latest headlines, and uncover the wonders of nature, all under the enlightened guidance of our host, Frank Santarella.
So first I want to introduce my co-host, Frank on Target, who I do the live stream radio show with. So Frank,
good morning. Good morning, Elaine.
So I have to say we're honored to have you here. And just before we get going, I understand you had a little hiccup with your dad.
Yes. Yes.
So how's he doing?
Well, thank you. Go ahead.
Well, he's United. And for those that don't know, he's United States Congressman Joe Wilson. He's a tremendous conservative. Somebody that conservatives all over this country widely respect. So, is he doing well?
Episode the other night, a medical issue that arose two nights ago, but thank goodness he was in at a location where there were a number of doctors and people, and they were able to get him to a hospital safely. Mm-hmm. I spoke with him that same night, and I've been in constant contact with my mother and his doctors, and we're incredibly grateful. You know, God is in control. And his doctors are fantastic. My mother has said nothing but wonderful things about him, and he is, we believe, on the road to recovery, and obviously we'll be back in the saddle again soon. But I really appreciate you, and by the way, the outpouring of support from around the state, and not just around the state, around the country. I probably dug out of 500 text messages to thank people for thinking of him, so we appreciate it.
And his life's work, his contribution to the governance of our country is appreciated. Okay, so let's maybe pivot. So can you give us a little background in what led up to filing this litigation? And I guess one of my overarching questions is, are you concerned about possibly modifying the 1993 National Voters Registration Act? Because that seems to be forming the basis of a lot of mischief in our country. But anyway, tell us a little bit about how South Carolina came to be part of this important litigation.
Well, if I may, I'd like to go up to 50,000 feet and drill back down. I think it's important for people to understand how I view the role of the states and the federal government under our system of federalism. And so I think it would be helpful for you to understand that. This is what kind of drives me. What drives me is that people, if you go back to the 1780s, a bunch of colonies got together. The Articles of Confederation were not working. They were not getting the job done. And so a group of people got together. They formed this, you know, constitutional convention to draft the Constitution. But there was a big debate on what the role should the states be completely sovereign? Should the federal government be very powerful? How do you put a balance between the two? So the states came together. And they created a constitutional framework which created a federal government. So I have to remind people that the states created the federal government. The federal government did not create the states. That is the principle, that is a core foundation principle in our republic. And a lot of people forget that, especially people on the left. They think that the federal government is supreme and that it can basically run roughshod over the states. Now, the states did delegate to the federal government under the Constitution, you know, certain powers. Congress, under Article 1, Section 8, has a long list of powers that Congress can do. Things like the Commerce Clause, coining money, raising funds for, you know, administering the Navy, the military, dealing with foreign governments. There are certain things they can do. Mm-hmm. But the federal government does not have a general police power. And the federal government can't just generally go out there and basically run roughshod over the states. Under the 10th Amendment, all the power not listed in the Constitution or prohibited by the Constitution are retained by the states.
Yes,
that is where your general police power is.
All those powers not enumerated are retained by the states.
Correct.
Extremely important to the whole structure of our government.
Absolutely. You are 100% correct. So you have to remind people that. And people think that, you know, we're kind of subjects of the federal government, and we're not. The federal government is a subject of the states. It's really supposed to be a partner with the states, if anything. It does things that the states cannot do for themselves. South Carolina can't negotiate a treaty with a foreign nation. You know, we can't coin money. That would create anarchy. And, you know, we are supposed to be able to rely on the federal government to protect our borders. So, unfortunately, they're not doing that right now.
Yeah, that hasn't been working out too well. But, yes, you're right.
No. So when you start with that precept that, you know, the federal government through Congress and the executive branch, the president signing off on the laws passed by the legislative branch, when they write laws that they do not have the authority to write under the Constitution, or executive branch officials reinterpret laws and assign meanings to words because they want a particular political outcome, you know, that is when I stand up and say, you can't do that. You know, executive branch agency, you can't redefine the term sex in the phrase on the basis of sex under Article 9. You can't rewrite what the word sex means. It doesn't mean gender identity. So you can't withhold funds from schools who refuse to comply with your ruling.
Attorney General Wilson, did the Chevron deference back in 1984 sort of open the door to this broad overreach of administrative agencies, this unelected fourth branch of our government, for them to interpret ambiguities in statutes passed by Congress? In a way, they're the entity that the statute was intended to control or restrict or contain in some way, and they get to decide for themselves how those ambiguities will be interpreted. And didn't that sort of create this enormous overreach of federal agencies that have now, they've enacted laws that are absolutely antithetical to any common sense understanding of what was intended, or even to the values we as Americans have, most especially this idea that there are more than two genders and that sort of nonsense. So you're aware that we need to rein in this runaway power of the not just the federal government, but these agencies of the federal government that are not responsive to the people at all, period.
No, absolutely. And Chevron deference from the Chevron case in 1984, I wouldn't say that it created this massive administrative state. I think that was really born between the Wilson administration, no relation to me, of course, in the early 20th century, and the Roosevelt, FDR's administration. And I think the administrative state was really ballooned during that time.
But you love, though, the Loper-Bright Enterprises v. Raimondo, the June 28th, 2024 decision, which sort of claws back. I think it opens the door to us reasserting some rights or regaining some rights or clawing back some rights from these administrative agencies based on the
yes.
So I'm thrilled about anchoring litigation and Supreme Court challenge, constitutional challenges grounded in Loper-Bright Enterprises, because I think it's a valuable tool that we have and we should use. So, but anyway, keep going. Let's keep going to, because I like your overview. So we're getting down to about 20,000 feet.
So yeah, we're coming in. I promise, I'm gonna land.
No, take your time.
But you mentioned Chevron, so I'm running down this rabbit hole with you. So okay. Chevron was in '84, and basically it's where the court said, look, the executive branch agencies are the ones that have to effectuate or enforce the laws that the legislative branch passes, and if there's ever an ambiguity in the law, the courts are going to give deference under the Chevron case. We're going to give deference to the administrative agencies in their interpretation of those ambiguities if they're reasonable. Now, the term reasonable is very broad.
Wait, it's very broad, but more than that. Do you think then that some legislators, certainly not your father, but some, can't actually draft legislation to save their lives, and they allow PACs or they allow special interests to propose legislation that they put their name on that have built into them ambiguities, which sort of gives this revolving door of private enterprise and government oversight, you know, these people that go back and forth between the agency that's regulating and the regulatory body, they create these laws that are intended to be ambiguous so that then these industry are basically deciding for themselves, because they control government agencies, they're deciding for themselves how our laws will be interpreted. If you followed that, do you sort of agree with it? It's not accidental. It's intentional.
Well,
after 40 years.
If you remember a few years ago, about a dozen years ago, when the Affordable Care Act, we call it Obamacare, was passed, Nancy
right.
Pelosi famously said, we yes. have to pass this law so we can find out what's in it.
Yes.
And that kind of exemplifies everything you just said.
Yes, and I used it as an example. It's a perfect example. The one time that Pelosi actually is a perfect example of something, I think it was intentional. I don't think it's accidental that there are now all these ambiguities. And I like that. She said we have to pass it to figure out what's in it. So now let's go back. We're still at about 20,000 feet. Take your time.
All right. Before you folks drop the landing gear, this is Frank Santarelli, and I'm on WVFF Radio, 97.7 LPFM here in Cottageville, South Carolina. And I understand you were down here last week, Attorney General, and sorry to have missed you. This is being simulcast on the radio, and as you can tell, Attorney General, I have my constitutional scholar here because I am certainly not. So if you carry on, we really appreciate your participation, and carry on. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. And again, I think it's important to understand the historical nature of our Constitution, and I wanted to give an overview and context to why I do what I do. So,
yes.
As you mentioned, Chevron was overturned 40 years later this past summer, where the Supreme Court says, no, you don't defer ambiguous language to the executive branch agencies. Congress, do your job and write clear language to begin with, and we're going to give it the plain meaning that it meant, which is the way that the founders of this republic intended it to work.
Yes.
You know, back in the old days, a bill was 1, 2, 3 pages long. Now they're 2,000 pages long. And then you
yes.
got 50,000 pages of regulations to implement the 2,000 pages of law. And
mm-hmm.
so that's where this administrative state has come from. And the unelected bureaucrats buried in the deep state of the federal government who were there, but they don't come and go with administrations. They reside there for decades. They write these rules and they govern us through administrative fiat. So the people you've never heard of and you will never vote for or against are writing rules that are basically miniature laws that determine the outcome of your everyday life. And that is not how our government was formed.
Absolutely. That's why it drives me nuts when people say I don't discuss politics. Politics governs from the minute you put your feet on the carpet. You know, you start your day, get out of bed, put your feet on the carpet, stand upright. You've already touched the chemicals in that carpeting, or the chemicals your children wear, the fire retardant chemicals that your children have to wear in their pajamas, or the fact that, you know, politics covers every decision of your life all day, every day. We need to encourage people to talk about politics all day, every day. Talk about it to the point that you understand policy and understand how it impacts you. You understand it so well, it's easy to have civil conversations about it. But anyway, let's keep going because we're at about 10,000 feet.
I wasn't sure.
So, you know, I want to give you an example of a very high-profile case I was on a couple of years ago, and it was an amicus brief. If you remember, in the wake of the 2020 election, Texas sued the state of Pennsylvania.
Yes.
And they alleged a number of things, including voter
yes.
fraud. They also alleged that there was a violation of the Electors Clause.
Yes.
In the days following that, I, along with a handful of other states, joined an amicus brief, which is a friend of the court brief.
Yes.
And we didn't join in the voter fraud allegations because that is very technical. We did join in and asked the Supreme Court to hear this case based on the violations of the Electors Clause. Let me make this very plain. In the Constitution, there are two clauses, two electors clauses under Article 1 and Article 2 that basically say states, you get to determine the time, manner, and location of federal elections and, state legislatures specifically. You write the rules for how you conduct your elections and in the Electoral College. Well, during COVID, you had situations where Pennsylvania is one example of a state. Judges in Pennsylvania were rewriting state laws on how to conduct an election for president in that state. For instance, they were saying the law said your ballots had to be in by 7 p.m. on election night. You had to be signed by the elector, and it had to at least be postmarked. If it was received after the closing of the polls, it had to be postmarked by that day in order for it to count. Judges said, you know what? COVID's got everybody, you know, locked in their houses, so we're going to waive all of that stuff, and we're going to let you collect ballots for, 3 or 5 days after the election's over. They don't have to be signed, and they don't even have to be postmarked.
And they never had the authority to say that. They never had that was what's so outrageous.
You know what?
The American people and even state legislators, they didn't even understand that they had the power to convene. They didn't need the governor's approval. They had the power to convene and object to that. But since this was a matter of first impression for the entire country, what was missing was people understanding what to do. We knew that we needed to do something. We had media telling us, there's nothing to see here, folks, and you're an election denier and a bad person if you object to the election. But good people, reasonable people, law-abiding people did not know where to turn for guidance and how to effectively address what was clearly, it was a stolen election. I just want to call it what it is. I'm not putting those words in your mouth. I'm responsible for them coming out of my mouth. But yes, yeah, so you had in Pennsylvania and other states, all sorts of unconstitutional actions taken by state actors, frankly. Okay, so keep going.
Well, and the reason it was important for us to highlight this is people like, why do you care how Pennsylvania conducts their elections? So I'm like, well, I don't care how Pennsylvania conducts their elections. But if a single secretary of state or a single judge or an elections commissioner can rewrite a state federal election law, a state law on federal election in that respective state, especially for president, that could affect the Electoral College, which affects all the states. And I say if the Supreme Court doesn't step in and provide the declaratory relief, basically saying, look, if you want to change the law to allow people to mail their ballots in a month after the election's over, state legislatures can write that law. I still disagree with it. It's a bad law, rife with fraud. But the state legislature has to determine the time, manner, and location. Federal governments have very limited means to regulate how elections or registration of elections is conducted. And that leads to the case I joined in with the nine other states in this particular circuit. You know, you've got the federal...
Now we have to back up a minute. The Supreme Court, because that Texas case is cited as being inaccurately, as being evidence that there was no proof of malfeasance in the 2020 election. That's not what the United States Supreme Court said. It said Texas didn't have standing to sue. It refused to hear the case. And I think it's a matter of well-settled law that courts don't want to issue declaratory judgments. So, but can you back up? Why did the United States Supreme Court, do you think it was a mistake for the United States Supreme Court not to have heard the case, the Texas case? And I think in hindsight, it was awful, frankly.
I agree with what Clarence Thomas wrote in his dissent. Clarence Thomas basically said, this is a very important question that needs to be addressed by this court. And there are rare opportunities to address this type of question. And he says, forget the presidency. You could have situations in which there are people running in lower offices where the margin of victory for a local state house member, senator, city council member, school board member, county commissioner, or dog catcher, the vote difference could be 10, 20, 30, 50, 100 votes. And if you're allowed to collect votes for 3 days after the election is over, you could have people committing fraud in all manner of races. And so Clarence Thomas basically said, this is the perfect time for us to take this up. We don't know when we'll get the chance to do it again. It needs to be answered. Can a judge basically rewrite an election law when the U.S. Constitution says only state legislatures can rewrite election laws? And Clarence Thomas says this is going to create problems for states for years to come if we don't address it. Of course, he was in the dissent on that one, but I agree with him. We should have taken the opportunity to answer that question to provide clarity and security in our elections.
I agree with you agreeing with him. Clarence Thomas, you know, he's in the crosshairs of every woke progressive liberal because he's effective, because he is a beacon of sanity and of constitutional order, I guess is a good way to say it, on the court. And his value, you know, I used to think that Antonin Scalia was the anchor, and I think that's a sort of a fair assessment. But Clarence Thomas, Justice Thomas, has certainly risen to the occasion. He is incredible. He's an incredible voice on the court, and somebody that our nation owes a debt of gratitude to. And looking back on that decision, I wish that he had been more persuasive in supporting, you know, in persuading the rest, enough members of the court to rule differently, to hear Texas's, because didn't Texas have over 280 pieces of evidence attached to their the lawsuit that were in fact evidence of malfeasance And, you know, when media says all of that was rejected and it was somehow they characterize it as being proven to be false, the Supreme Court doesn't review evidence that way. That's not the function of the Supreme Court. They address matters of law, not findings of fact. But they never made that determination at all about the quality of the evidence that Texas had attached to their lawsuit.
No, they didn't. And you were right. They never even answered the question. They simply booted on standing grounds.
Yeah.
And I supported what Clarence Thomas said. But this leads to the case at hand that you asked me about at the very beginning. Now we're landing. You know, the federal government gets its directives and its powers. They're enumerated in Article 1 for Congress and Article 2 for the executive branch. And the ability to regulate or conduct a voter registration or regulate elections is very limited at the federal level. The state legislatures more specifically are charged with that. And so the Biden administration, through executive order in 2021, are trying to direct federal monies to go toward voter registration drives that the federal government does not have the authority to do. I'm not against voter registration drives. I'm not against, this isn't about me trying to prevent people from registering to vote. I won't equal and fair access, but I want people to follow the law. I want people to follow the rule of law. And when you're cutting corners or you're ignoring the rule of law, it starts to snowball. And so that's why I joined in this suit that was filed in the Kansas District Court with nine other states. And so it's the same principle from the Texas v. Pennsylvania case from nearly 4 years ago.
Mm-hmm. And now you've included that the defendants are the U.S. Treasury, the Department of Justice, Department of Interior, Department of Agriculture, Department of Labor, Department of Health and Human Services, Department of Housing and Urban Development, and the Department of Education. That's my home run list of departments I'd like to sue the holy out of. But basically what you're saying is, because actually under this 1993 National Voter Registration Act, you're not opposed, like you just said, you're not opposing to them registering voters. But what you asked the Biden administration for, or the attorneys general asked under the Freedom of Information Act, you asked to see details of who exactly, which organizations under the umbrella of this executive order that Biden passed on March 10th of 2021, what was the exact plan and who are they empowering? What sort of organizations are they empowering to help voters get registered? Because they were probably, I think the claim might be that these are woke progressive liberal organizations that coincidentally are registering everybody to be a woke progressive liberal Democrat.
Well,
is that kind of where we're at?
That is the intent, in my opinion. That is how I interpret what's going on. Obviously, I'm kind of cynical about all of this, but, you know, being in this job for as many years as I've been has made me cynic. And, of course, people who love power in the federal government want more power in the federal government. They want a big, robust government capable of doing everything, anything and everything it wants, regardless of what the rules say, regardless of what the Constitution says. And they don't really care about the authority of the states. And again, people who want to give all this power to the federal government to do things that they agree with have to realize one day the federal government will use that power to do things they don't agree with. The government never gives the power back. It never cedes power back. It has to be wrenched away. And that's what people need to understand. So for my liberal friends out there who love a big, robust, powerful federal government, one day that government is going to use that same power that you support today to do things against you that you disapprove of tomorrow, and you're not going to be able to do anything about it.
We saw that with COVID. We saw that with those vaccination mandates for unsafe, ineffective, unproven vaccines that had only marginal effectiveness at best, that harmed people, killed people all around the world. And we saw it in the denial of our ability to use ivermectin, hydroxychloroquine, and other proven, safe, inexpensive, Nobel Prize winning medicine. So, you know, we talk about wanting sovereignty over our bodies. That's a big issue, supposedly, with more progressive liberals. What could be more antithetical to sovereignty over your body than being forced to put these dangerous vaccines into your children or yourself? So, yeah, you're right. You give power to the federal government, you will never get it back, and it absolutely will be. It's being used right now to force illegal immigrants into communities all over this country. The community doesn't have the resources to support these groups of people. And I don't know if you see that in South Carolina, but they're certainly seeing it in communities all across this country where it's straight. It doesn't matter. You know, nobody is opposed to legal immigration at all. That's not the issue. But illegal immigration that stresses the resources of the community, it's antithetical to any legitimate interest. In fact, it's actually a threat to the safety of our country to allow these unvetted people in. So, yeah, for sure.
Well,
you have federal power government and you're in big trouble.
You hit on immigration, and I do want to say this. It's not just what the federal government does, and sometimes what it doesn't do that's offensive to me as well. So the federal government says we are the one that is supposed to protect the borders and regulate the immigration processes. So the states say, fine. Well, and during the Obama administration refused to secure the border. The state of Arizona, with dealing with an illegal immigrant problem, decided to pass a complementary law to federal law that allowed Arizona to secure its own borders right there at the southern border. The Obama administration sued them and saying, you can't pass a law that does what we want to do. And Arizona said, but you're not doing it, so let us do it for you. And the federal government said no. Fast forward to last year, state of Texas passed SB4, same thing. They say, Mr. Biden, you're not enforcing our southern border, so we're going to pass a complementary law. It doesn't contradict you. It simply allows us to do what you're not doing, and it goes in line with what you want to do. And the Biden administration, like the Obama administration, sued the state of Texas to prevent them from implementing their own border security measures. Mm-hmm. So the federal government is occupying an area of law and then refusing to do what the law tells it to do, and then preventing other states from coming in and doing it for them. So it's preventing anybody from enforcing the borders. Neither the federal or the state are allowed to do it. And so it's what they're not doing. They're not enforcing the laws, and then they prevent states from doing it. And so that is what creates a lot of frustration for people like me. Because I'll tell you right now, every state is a border state. The fentanyl, the methamphetamine, the cocaine, the heroin, the violent Mexican drug cartels that are coming across, the Mexican gangs that are coming across, is pouring into South Carolina. There's currently 32,000 unaccompanied minors that came into the interior of the U.S. during the Biden administration that they cannot find. They don't know where they are. Where do you think? Yeah, that could be feeding the human trafficking epidemic.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think the number's even higher. There's some credible numbers that are even higher than that. And where did they all go? Totally, totally. I agree with you, 100%.
Well, I'm going to keep fighting, and I'm going to keep bringing these suits, and hopefully we'll get a reprieve in January, God willing, and the creek don't rise. But I want to say thank you. You're very well read, and you came into this thing very prepared. I was going to jump on your back and let you carry me through this whole interview, but I really appreciate the forum to be able to talk about what we're doing, and we're going to keep up the good fight.
Attorney General, you are a blessing to our state. I got to tell you that. We down here in the Low Country pretty much follow your actions up there in Columbia. I got to tell you, with the support that you have down here, anywhere you want to go in your career, we're behind you. It's just incredible. Like I said, we've been watching you very closely. In the future, sometime in the future, we're going to have Attorney General Chris Kobach on. And if you wanted to be with us at that time, you would be more than welcome. I know your schedule is tight and you scheduled a half an hour. If you want to continue and your schedule allows, feel free to. And I just want to remind you that... go ahead.
Well, and I just wanted to say thank you for your very kind words. I'm incredibly flattered. I'm honored to serve as your attorney general. Chris Kobach is a very good friend of mine. And if you ever have him on, I would love to tag team an interview with you guys. Just contact my office. My staff is telling me I got to get ready for another meeting, so I'm going to have to run on this one. But I'm always available to come back on to have conversations about very serious issues that affect all of us, and to also to be held accountable. I want to be accountable to you, the voters, who are my boss. And so anytime you want to come interview me about something I'm doing or not doing, I am happy to come on. And again, thank you for this amazing opportunity to serve and to be on this podcast. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Attorney General.
Elaine, we can look forward to Attorney General Wilson being on when we have Attorney General Kobach on. So,
absolutely.
That's a good thing.
We'll set that up with you because we are going to follow more. The lawsuit was filed, but there isn't more than just basically what we talked about now. We need to see how it winds its way through the courts. But Attorney General, we want to let you go because we understand that your time is valuable. So thank you for just showing up and giving us an overview. I think that we as American citizens need to have a better perspective on why our elected officials do what they do. And I think you represent the state of South Carolina very, very well. So thank you.
Thank you very much. God bless you.
All right. And thank you. And God bless you as well. This is Frank on Target, and we're on WVFF 97.7 LPFM in Cottageville, South Carolina. Thank you, folks, and I'm out of here.
We here at WVFF thank you for tuning in to Frank on Target, your source for straight talk on global politics and outdoor escapades and controversy. Until next time, stay on target with Frank. You're listening to Veterans for Freedom Radio, 97.7 FM.